Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Obviously, it's going to be an eventful day in the markets today with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the closure over the weekend of Signature Bank of New York.
Yes, not our Signature Bank.
Signature Bank of New York is a entirely different bank than Signature Bank here in Chicago that you hear advertising on our airwaves. That Signature Bank, the one in Chicago, is all good. We're going to talk to Kevin Bestuga, one of the co-founders, at the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. Signature Bank in New York had some problems with crypto investments, among other things, and were shut down by regulators over the weekend. There was an announcement yesterday about the Fed guaranteeing all of the unsecured deposits in both of those financial institutions. But there's a lot here to unpack, and it's going to be a wild day on the street. We'll talk to Christopher Whalen more about that at the top of the 6 o'clock hour. But a little bit of housekeeping and fun from the festivities over the weekend, including March Madness here at the local level. Bennett Academy.
Oh, that's right. How did you guys do?
Losing in the state final after demolishing New Trier in the semis. Losing in the state final. Bennett still never went has won a state title. To Moline.
Oh, good for them.
Good news for Moline. Well, good news for Moline is good news for the Iowa Hawkeyes because they've got two prospects that are going to Iowa that were the difference between Bennett, whose leading scorer was out, but nevertheless.
Wait, why was he out? Because I was trying to look for the score of the New Trier game, and I couldn't find it. What was the New Trier score?
They won by 18 or 20 or something. So then Moline wins, so congratulations to Moline there, representing the Quad Cities. Interestingly, too, 3A, so Simeon dispatched with St. Ignatius, as one would expect in the semis, but then lost to Metamoro. In the state finals, surprised to me, at least. That was for the 3A. And then, I don't know, 2A, 1A, you know, whoever won those state titles, congratulations.
And if anybody knows, you could call us, 312-642-5600.
So there's March Madness at the state level, state basketball tournament. Of course, at the collegiate level, Iowa somehow snuck in to the tournament.
Okay.
So you can predict Iowa's going to win the national championship,
exactly,
as you do every year.
Yeah, I put them down every year. Uh-huh. Well, we did win the Big Ten title last year, but not this year. Purdue won it this year. But yes,
right.
Yes, of course, because we're going to do our
Walk down
March
memory
Madness
lane with Iowa.
Bowl. Yeah. Right. Justin already sent out the Evite.
Uh-huh.
Did you fill it out yet, your bracket?
Not quite. So Iowa's in. My alma mater, Northwestern, is in.
Okay.
Not that I'm super excited about that. They play Boise State. Winnable game. They'll probably lose. Illinois is in. They're playing Arkansas. Again, winnable game. They'll probably lose. Big Ten is just really, really fairly mediocre this year. I mean, Penn State in the conference championship game with Purdue and held their own with Purdue. I don't know. I just think the Big Ten's soft. So any slights that anybody wants to talk about if they're March Madness fans? Slights would obviously apply to only the collegiate level since you play your way into the state tournament games. I don't want to go too, Joe Minardi here in bracketology, but Iowa probably,
say it. Just say
I don't
it.
Know. I don't know if I
just
if,
own
if,
it.
If I was calling, if I was on the committee, I don't think Iowa gets in. I think Clemson probably gets in for me. Maybe North Carolina ahead of Iowa, but it's just not a tournament. It just doesn't seem like a tournament without the Tar Heels. So college basketball, I don't know.
Is this the first time they haven't made the tournament, North Carolina?
No. First time in history? No.
Well, in recent memory? I don't know.
Pretty unusual, right. And so, and then, of course, you had, and just in terms of the bread and circuses, which is what we're really talking about, but before we have to talk about all things dismal, which is real life, focusing on the bread and circuses for a minute. Also take any comments on the Academy Awards. Didn't watch it because who watches these self-congratulatory award shows for these simpletons? So some of them are great artists, but nonetheless simpletons and barbarians. So any slights, anything that you wanted to... Well, there were definitely slights at the Oscars. Anything you want to discuss about slights or with the Oscars, with the NCAA, anything you want to address with the state tournament? Speak now, forever hold your peace.
312-642-5600. Or you could text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You have nothing?
I didn't watch.
You didn't have an Oscar party?
I didn't. And I always watch the Oscars, but we had a little family thing yesterday, so I wasn't able to watch the Oscars. But Michelle Yeoh, who won Best Actress, made a remark at CNN's Don Lemon about her. She's past her prime. So we'll get that for you guys because that's pretty. Yeah.
Isn't that so cute?
So cute. How creative. I'm not past my prime.
I will say, for those of you who are cinephiles, even if you didn't watch the Oscars, even if you don't care that much about who wins, which film wins Best Picture and so forth, the Everything All at Once. Yeah,
Everything All at Once. Won everything. That's all you need to know. Best
all
Actress, Supporting Actress.
And basically all at
best
once.
Best Film.
The best movie of the year was, and it was not close, was Tar with Cate Blanchett. But here's the thing about it. If you're going to see a movie, if you're going to see one of the, I want to see one of the nominated movies, then you see Tar. Okay. If that's all you have the bandwidth for, that's the prioritization, I would argue.
Did you see Everything Everywhere All at Once?
Uh-huh.
Well, was it good?
And so, as I said, Tar is the movie that you want to see.
Okay, but what's...
That was the best picture of 2022. Cate Blanchett was genius. She also should have won Best Actress, but I understand this is Hollywood and you have to do things where you lead with sort of political imperatives. The reason that Tar didn't win is because it presented a really nuanced commentary and provoked nuanced thinking about the woke culture in America, in the West today. And, you know, I just want to say something about that without going too deep into Tar is this filmmaker, Todd Field, who not too many people appreciate. This Tar was his film. He hasn't made a lot of films, but the films he has made have all been exquisite. And if you want to go down a rabbit hole with Todd Field, which you should, and experience the rest of his oeuvre, I would say see Tar. Then see his two of his previous films, In the Bedroom and Little Children. If you want like really intelligent, thoughtful, nuanced, non-cliched sort of social, cultural commentary and content, that would just be my advice and counsel. If you want to just, you know, spend a couple of hours, you know, in a state of sort of addled intellectual suspension, then, you know, you can go see just about anything else, including Everything All at Once, which was, you know, it's like a...
What's it about? I don't even know.
It's okay. It was okay. It wasn't even that fun. It's got a supernatural element to it. I didn't even find it that fun. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, guys. Good morning. So I turned on WGN a little earlier to just see what the dresses look like, because I know, Amy, you appreciate a beautiful gown.
What was Paul Conrad wearing?
Oh, stop. He wasn't even on. So the dresses, Amy, what was your favorite? Did you watch the whole thing? I didn't see one minute of it.
No.
Who was the prettiest? Oh, you didn't watch?
Harry Styles, I thought, wore the prettiest.
Lady Gaga had a nice dress, yes.
So I just took Lady Gaga did. All right, I'll check that out later. Dan, the two movies you just said that Tad Field made, you said Tar is the one to watch with Cate Blanchett, correct?
Right. That was nominated this year. And then two additional movies that he made, In the Bedroom and Little Children.
Little Children. Okay, I got it. I this is how I will plan the rest of my week here and what I'm going to have to do. And
appropriately.
Yeah,
so.
you're my entertainment. You know, you are my news guy, entertainment.
I'm your entertainment.
I get all my hear everything, Dan.
Yeah.
No,
all at once.
Dan. I don't listen to anyone else. So that's what people are like. Will you listen to something else? I'm like, no, I
no.
haven't.
Why, no, what's the point?
Yeah. If you're going to listen, you should see the movie A Man Called Otto. I've watched it.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that, Amy. Yeah. So this is the problem. I listen. No, I love you guys, but then I talk to Sean, and then when I talk to Sean, I'm like, you get me all screwed up, Sean. We are,
yeah,
you know, like
don't,
I'm
don't
all the M560. Well, you know, I hear you, Dan, but I love
you. You want to stay in civil society. You listen to us.
I hate family.
You can't pick family. I get it. I understand.
You can't, you know, and he loves me. I mean, we love it. We're family.
Right.
Somebody texted in.
We're family. Huh? Yeah.
Thanks, Mary.
Somebody texted in. I heard there was no chance of Jimmy Kimmel getting slapped, so I didn't watch the Oscars.
There you go. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You mentioned March Madness. Well, I've got a different version of March Madness.
Bob, can I guess? Does it have something to do with engineering?
Yes,
it does.
Woo! It does.
Mm-hmm. 47 teams from around the Midwest, a team from Turkey, a team from Canada. Wow. They battle it out with their robots. It's not a, a destructive robot, but the robots had to play a game. And for Amy, District 214, yippee, they won it. And they go on to the national finals in Houston in a world competition.
Oh.
And
it was actually pretty cool because I saw it on Channel 5 and Channel 9. They all covered it.
Yep, it was big news. And then for Amy, with a man called Otto. Love I did not see the Tom Hanks version. I saw the original version, which came out of Sweden.
Yep. The book was written from Sweden. Yep.
Yeah, that's the thing, Bob. Thanks. Well, that's why Tar is, and some of the other movies too, but because everything else in Hollywood is like a remake. There's no new. I mean, I know there's only 7 plot lines in the Western tradition, but you can take different angles in. Everything is a remake, so that is this movie Living, which is quite good with Bill Nye, but it's a remake. Essentially, it's a remake of Iroku, which is a Kurosawa film from 70 years ago. I mean, there's just like no, there's a I mean, I you can do remakes, and it can be.
A Man
you know.
Called Otto is a wonderful remake. It's a great film. It's so sweet. You'll laugh, you'll
yeah,
cry. It's a great
so sweet.
Cast.
Yeah, it sounds like the typical sentimental claptrap that comes out of Hollywood. Watch Tar.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we move on from the Oscars, one more comment. I I forgot, and Mike Scott's newscast reminded me that Brendan Fraser won Best Actress, Best Actor. Why is there two categories? I don't know.
Oh, that's right.
But anyway, for The Whale, and you know, I was excited to see it, and classic mistake. Anything that's being hyped by like the establishment entertainment press, you should be wary of. I should know better. Huge disappointment, pun intended, The Whale.
What was it, a guy that overeats, binge eats or something, right?
Yeah.
And The Whale. See how I'm picking up on this title thing?
It was, first of all, I loathed every single character in the film, which is always a bad start. You're supposed to have empathy for Brendan Fraser. I found him pathetic and detestable in the role. I mean, I'm not saying he's... You know, this wasn't a lovely comeback performance, and I know he's dealt with some issues, and that's all well and good. I'm just talking about the film. And the film was, like, so on the nose with respect to the issues it sought to highlight. It was very preachy and not particularly creative. No aspect of it. The relationship between Fraser and his daughter, Fraser and his former paramour's sister, Fraser and his students, because in the role he plays a teacher who teaches online classes and he never posts his picture because he's this, you know, humongous guy and he's embarrassed and so forth. It's just so beat you about the head and neck area with the message. Very mediocre film. Good performance. It's something to see. Brendan Fraser in this character and what they did sort of physically in terms of the presentation. It's rather grotesque, but that's the point. I get it. But in terms of the actual quality of the film, and I know it didn't win Best Picture, but it's just, I don't know. It was a fine performance by Brendan Fraser. It was not, that memorable other than just the physical image of him on screen. I don't know, but other people have seen it, but I just found it, like, really sort of a snore. Okay. Anyway, all right.
Does he get thin at the end? Anything positive?
Yeah, he gets sense of Richard Simmons sweating to the oldies tapes.
And he gets on the diabetes drug, and then when
he gets Ozempic or something, and then they cut to black, fade to black, and then you're supposed to think, oh, he's thin again, and everybody lives happily ever after. Not exactly, okay. Not exactly how it ends. Okay, let's get on to more pressing matters, like our ability to express ourselves, like I just did, like we do every day on this show, without. The state, through their sentinels, that would be the big tech companies, coming in and stifling individual opinion, debate among a free people, you know, those things. Last week, the weaponization of government subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee had a hearing that featured two men of the left. And two of the journalists who've been providing us all of these Twitter files, all the information over the last several months that has substantiated what we knew to be true about how Twitter behaved in advance of the 2020 election. Yes, but that's just one example. Just in general with doing exactly what I was just describing, having their minders, leftists all, stifle anything that wasn't leftist orthodoxy. Schellenberger opened his testimony before the committee, talking about this censorship industrial complex, sort of updating the Dwight D. Eisenhower warning.
Today, American taxpayers are unwittingly financing the growth and power of a censorship industrial complex run by America's scientific and technological elite, which endangers our liberties and democracy. I'm grateful for this opportunity to offer this testimony and sound the alarm over the shocking and disturbing emergence of state-sponsored censorship in the United States of America. The Twitter files, state attorneys general lawsuits, and investigative reporters have revealed a large and growing network of government agencies, academic institutions, and non-governmental organizations that are actively censoring American citizens, often without their knowledge, on a range of issues.
That's an important point that he makes there, and he develops it, talking about academic institutions and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, where they essentially serve as the middleman between the state and the big tech companies. It's not us saying that Dan Prof's account should be suspended. It's the Atlantic Council that went to Twitter and said, Dan Prof is a threat to national security, so please suspend his account. And he explains in a little bit more detail, does Schellenberger.
The Stanford Internet Observatory, the University of Washington, the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab, and Graphica have all inadequately disclosed ties to the Department of Defense, the CIA, and other intelligence agencies. They work with multiple U.S. government agencies to institutionalize censorship research and advocacy within dozens of other universities and think tanks. It is important to understand how these groups function. They are not publicly engaging with their opponents in an open exchange of ideas. They aren't asking for a national debate over the limits of the First Amendment. Rather, they are creating blacklists of disfavored people and then pressuring, cajoling, and demanding that social media platforms censor, de-amplify, and even ban the people on those lists.
You understand that wrinkle, and it's an important one. And it also speaks to the left's control of all these cultural institutions, the academy, nonprofit policy space. I know there are conservative think tanks, but there are these NGOs that are funded by wealthy leftists that serve as intermediaries. They also are funded, in some of them, by government, academic institutions. You just mentioned Stanford, among others. Also, in part, even if they're private, funded by the government through research funding, taxpayer-provided research funding. So big tech and government, yes, but don't forget about the middlemen, because to forget about the middlemen is to forget about all these other institutions that have been corrupted and are now pushing for the silencing of dissent, the progression. Remember back in the day, the Patriot Act and the discussions of government data collection, when clap on, clap off, Jim Clapper lied to us about the metadata collection going on at DNI. Remember how some libertarian-oriented folks, some conservatives skeptical of unlimited government power, even under the auspices of national security, said, you know, dangerous servant, fearful master here. Or fearful servant, dangerous master. How do we make sure this is limited to counterterrorism? How do we make sure that counterterrorism isn't redefined into being something more expansive than we're talking about here in the present, post 9/11? Well, we failed. And so this progression, Schellenberger describes, where we are versus where we started.
Importantly, the bar for bringing in military-grade government monitoring and speech-countering techniques has moved from, quote, countering terrorism to, quote, countering extremism to countering simple misinformation, otherwise known as being wrong on the Internet. The government no longer needs a predicate of calling you a terrorist or an extremist to deploy government resources to counter your political activity. The only predicate it needs is simply the assertion that the opinion you expressed on social media is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. You disagree. That is misinformation. Let's put the wheels in motion to silence this person if we find this person to be a threat, not to public safety, not to our democracy, but to our viewpoint, to our ability to persuade people to go along with whatever it is we're proposing. That's where things are at. And it was remarkable to hear the back and forth between some leftist members of Congress, like DWS, you know, she's the that chick with the Todd Christensen lid from the 80s. She's still sporting
yes,
that.
I know. Not giving it up, ever.
Yeah, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she went right after Matt Taibbi.
She berated him and insulted him.
And remember, Taibbi wrote a book calling Trump a doofus. You know, Taibbi and Schellenberger are both men of the center left. Schellenberger spent his career as an environmental activist. He famously wrote the apology a couple of years ago for engaging and fomenting some of the more radical and fact-free environmental activism. But he's still, you know, of that sort of mindset. But these are both people, Taibbi and Schellenberger, that are throwbacks to a time when there were men and women on the left who believed in peaceful pluralism. There are few such people today. And that's what they're describing, not what I'm describing. And to the extent that you wander off the reservation is the extent you get the wrap-up smear routine from Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Attention is a powerful drug. Eyeballs, money, prominence, attention, all of it points to problems with accuracy and credibility. And the larger point, which is social media companies are not biased against conservatives. And if anything, they ignored their own policies by allowing Trump and other MAGA extremists to post incessant lies, endangering public safety and even our democracy.
She accuses Matt Taibbi of, you know, making money off this. You increased your Twitter followers, your Substack subscribers. Taibbi said, I don't know, it's about break even because I've also spent a bunch of money to hire more people to work for me as journalists, as investigators. But that's the smear. And then she goes on to a segue from the smear to saying, well, what's really happening is there's not enough censorship. And this was the repeated refrain of those leftist members of Congress. First of all, there's no evidence that what you're saying is true, and there's a lot of evidence. And secondly, to the extent it's true, it's not going far enough. There's no conservative bias. In point of fact, there should be more silencing of dissenting viewpoints, conservative viewpoints on social media. You just heard Debbie Wasserman Schultz say it. Remember the wrap-up smear? 6 years ago, Nancy Pelosi described what they do, and some on the right do it too. It's a tool of politics, but let's recognize it for what it is. Matt Taibbi, who was this journalist, is New York Times bestselling author, man of the left, providing all this information from wherever he got it, presumably Musk, but he's not going to disclose his sources, pressed as he was to do so. And now it's Matt Taibbi, cynical capitalist. You're just making money on this. There's no legitimate point of view you have. You're just a vulture capitalist, which is what, of course, they call all capitalists. Nancy Pelosi on the wrap-up smear. Remember how it works?
We call it the wrap-up smear. If you want to talk politics, we call it the wrap-up smear. You smear somebody with falsehoods and all the rest. And then you merchandise it. And then you write it. And they'll say, see, it's reported in the press that this, 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 and this. So they have that validation that the press reported the smear. And then it's called the wrap-up smear. Now I'm going to merchandise the press's report on the smear that we made. And it's a tactic.
It's a tactic. And that's exactly what Debbie Wasserman Schultz was doing. Let's call Matt Taibbi a vulture capitalist. Let's say the only reason he's doing this is for money. He's just a mercenary of Musk's. Let's say, look at how he doubled his Twitter followers. Look at how he doubled or increased his Substack subscribers. You're just doing this for money. And so that's the exchange that gets reported. And now Debbie Wasserman Schultz will run around saying, well, you know, as the Washington Post reported, Matt Taibbi has seen an exponential increase in his Twitter followers and his Substack subscribers. So he's making big money on this. That's the Washington Post reporting on it. I lob the smear, which is completely off point and without foundation, that's his motivation. And the Post, the New York Times picks up on it, and then I reference the Post of the New York Times. Hey, that's not me saying it. That's right there reported in black and white in the papers of record. Welcome to the party, Matt Taibbi, Michael Schellenberger. Huh? Taibbi went on Dan Bongino's show, and we've had Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger on the show before. We'll get them back. But he went on, I mean, this is where they're welcome because we actually believe in debate and freedom of expression on our show, as many conservatives do, so they can have their say, even where there's still a lot of disagreement, as there is between like someone like me and someone like Taibbi or Schellenberger. But nonetheless, He went on with Dan Bongino over the weekend on Fox to recount his testimony and the evidence.
Twitter, Facebook, Google, and other companies developed a formal system for taking in moderation requests from every corner of government.
So you're not going to tell us when Musk first approached you?
Again, Congresswoman, asking a journalist to reveal
so
a source.
So then you consider Mr. Musk to be the direct source of all this?
No, now you're trying to get me to say that he is the source. I just can't answer your question.
But if we can take off the tinfoil hat, that there's not a vast conspiracy.
Are you being paid to be here today, either through consulting fees,
no,
campaign contribution to your next
not.
Run?
Data was given to these so-called journalists before SNAP.
I'm not a so-called journalist. I've won the National Magazine Award, the I.F. Stone Award for Independent Journalism, and I've written 10 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers.
So that was some more of the assaults that Taibbi was subject to per his testimony as the lead into his conversation with Bongino.
Well, originally what we thought was going on was that only the FBI and DHS maybe a few other agencies were directly telling companies like Twitter to pull down a few accounts here and there. But as time went on, we learned that actually there's a whole complex of organizations and NGOs. A lot of them are state-funded, some of them are entirely state-funded, that are sending huge lists of names to these companies. And that's the primary route by which people are taken off places like Twitter or Facebook or any social media site.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So this was the scene at Silicon Valley Bank on Friday.
Now you listen to me. I want trading reopened right now. Get those brokers back in here. Turn those machines back on. Turn those machines back on.
Yeah, unfortunately that didn't happen for Don Amici, but no worries. Because the woman who recently retired after her run as Captain Kangaroo and is now our Treasury Secretary was on Face the Nation on Sunday explaining that they're working on it and they hope to have something squared away by the end of the day.
Well, let me say America's economy relies on a safe and sound banking system that can provide for the credit needs of our households and businesses. So whenever a bank, especially one like Silicon Valley Bank with billions of dollars in deposits, fails, it's clearly a concern. From the standpoint of depositors, many of which may be small businesses, they rely on access to their funds to be able to pay the bills that they have, and they employ tens of thousands of people across the country. We've been hearing from those depositors and other concerned people this weekend. So let me say that I've been working all weekend with our banking regulators to design appropriate policies to address this situation. I can't really provide further details at this time, but what I do want to do is emphasize that the American banking system is really safe and well capitalized.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I feel safe. Yeah.
Do you feel, listening to that, that Janet Yellen is a simpleton, or she just thinks you are?
She thinks we are.
Some combination of the two is also possible. More failures expected, Captain?
Let me just say that we want to make sure that the troubles that exist at one bank don't create contagion to others that are sound. And a goal always of supervision and regulation is to make sure that contagion can't occur.
Right, except it did.
It did. Signature Bank of New York.
Well, sort of different kettle, but yeah, still a failure. So bailouts coming or no, Captain?
And we're certainly not looking. And the reforms that have been put in place means that we're not going to do that again. But we are concerned about depositors and are focused on trying to meet their needs.
We're not going to do that again. Well, a release that was sent out by the Department of Treasury last evening said just the opposite, that unsecured debt holders and shareholders, certain unsecured debt holders, shareholders will not be protected, but they're otherwise going to guarantee the depositors at both Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank of New York. No losses will be borne by the taxpayer. How does that work? You just print money? Oh, the banking system, Federal Reserve will make available additional funding to eligible depository institutions. And then you're going to impose a fee on banks to allegedly recompense the Fed. And how do those fees work? And then they turn back onto their customers. So this is a bailout by other nomenclature and other means. By the way, I do have to note here in terms of trying to understand where this all started. This article in 2021, New York Times reporting, fall of 2021. Banks are binging on bonds, but not because they want to. Banks are washing deposits, their customers are taking out fewer loans, so they have little choice but to buy up government debt, even if it means skimpy profits. Huh. Couldn't see that coming then, Silicon Valley Bank, as well as these banking regulators that are always at the tip of the spear preventing contagions, as Captain Yellen was telling us. Well, they apparently were surprised to learn that bond prices move inverse to interest rates. And so Silicon Valley Bank was caught on the wrong side of that inverse relationship that necessitated the margin call and the capital call. And the response from the VC world prompted the run. So now we're going to have a moral hazard that was created by these modern monetary theorists cured by another moral hazard, the backdoor bailout. Do I have that right? Well, let's ask somebody who has more expertise in this area than I do. Christopher Whalen, investment banker and chairman of Whalen Global Advisors. He's the author of Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, and editor for the Institutional Risk Analyst. Chris, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. You can't really make this up, can you?
This FUBAR situation we have in the financial sector, I mean, do I have this right, that the MMTers are using MMT policy to cure the negative results of their MMT policy?
No. Unfortunately, as before, as in 2008, the banking industry will largely clean up the mess. Other than Bear and Citi, of course, who ended up in the arms of the federal government, the U.S. banking industry picked up the tab in 2008, and they will pick up the tab for this. So effectively, the private shareholders of banks are paying for Janet and Jay's manipulation of the bond market. And this, you know, is the end. In other words, we convinced everybody that interest rates would only ever go down. We convinced everybody that stocks and bonds at the same time would only ever go up, which is not normal. And then, you know, once we turned off the magic, machine, the MMT machine, if you will, we returned to normal. And the guys at Signature and Silicon Valley Bank were asleep. You know, you don't have 40% of your book in mortgage-backed securities. That's what Silicon Valley Bank did. That's a screw-up. They deserve to fail. But the Fed helped them. Let's put it that way.
Well, right. I mean, per that New York Times story, in terms of the incentives they present, but this moral hazard now you're creating of, I understand why, but it's always sort of like one more go around here. This moral hazard you're creating is saying, well, for depositors, we're going to guarantee because we don't want startups, tech startups in Silicon Valley to not right. be able to make payroll and so on and so forth.
But it's the private banks that are picking up the tab here, not the Fed. And when they say that it's not a taxpayer bailout, kind of, sort of true, but they will pay through inflation. You see, the real bottom line for me in the last couple of days is that we've realized finally that the Fed can't raise rates anymore. Having manipulated the bond market so that really three-quarters of all mortgages and all corporate bonds are now priced between, say, a 2% coupon and 5%. Okay, you can't then move the market 600 basis points and not expect that every bank in the country is going to be insolvent. Today, if you really look at the numbers, if you mark both the securities and the loans, every bank in the country is pretty close to insolvent. And this is because of the Fed. So, you know, they created the problem, and now they're going to ask the private banking industry to pick up any losses that will accrue to the FDIC's insurance fund.
Yeah, but this... ultimately, I mean, you sort of said it, but I want to emphasize it. Ultimately, this all redounds to, you know, Joe Punchclock and Sally Housecoat. One way or
right.
the other.
Higher prices at the grocery store.
Yeah, that's a backdoor bailout as far as I'm concerned, because this is all artificially created by these mystics, and that includes exactly. some in the private banking sector as well. And then who pays the freight ultimately? Well, it's exactly what I said.
But this system is built on inflation. Inflation is the American pastime. And, you know, we have Humphrey Hawkins, which was this weird socialist compromise from the 70s where Congress said, well, you have to make full employment reality. We thought we could legislate reality in our hubris, right? So now here we are, and it clearly doesn't work. The Fed cannot pursue both. And yet no one in Congress has the wit to realize this. And, you know, think about last week. Nobody asked Jay Powell about banks in 2 days of hearing.
Right.
Nobody in the media asked him about banks, and he didn't mention it. It was clearly not top of mind.
Yeah, but did he know what was coming?
No, they had no idea. When you see FDIC standing up bridge banks mm-hmm. instead of announcing sales, it means they didn't have time to sell the bank.
Well, didn't they try to sell it?
That's,
you know.
Yeah.
And anyone who's anyone in Silicon Valley, that's the bank to use if you have a startup.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's
yeah,
the hip, woke thing to do.
Yeah, you just want the franchise and their relationships. You could fix the bank. So I anticipate that Silicon Valley Bank will be sold. But the holding company, the thing you owned stock in last week, is going to file bankruptcy probably.
Well, Silicon Valley Bank was with the U.K., branch was
right.
just bought by HSBC, right?
Mm-hmm. For a dollar. They assume the deposits to protect
yeah.
the depositors. They
right.
get the assets for nothing.
Right.
Off they go.
Oh my God. 2023, America's best banks, according to Forbes. Silicon Valley.
you got
one of America's best
now.
Banks.
Seriously?
Financial superstar, Silicon Valley Bank. Not kidding.
I know.
Well, Forbes is like a tabloid for the financial
yeah.
industry these days, right?
This former employee of Lehman Brothers loaded them up with mortgage-backed securities, 40% of the balance sheet. Most banks usually don't keep more than about high single digits for Treasury in terms of liquidity. These guys had cash they couldn't lend, so they stuck it in the risk-free securities, right? These all are very low-risk securities in the bank regulatory world, and yet they have huge market risk because of the Fed.
Well,
the market risk has now killed the bank.
But there again, who says they're risk-free? The government regulators. The financial mystics. They're the ones saying risk-free, risk-free. Right, because they're backed by, right, moral hazard. But then there's this sort of like financial literacy 101 relationship between bond prices and interest rates. These guys don't know about it. Well, somebody did because the CEO of Silicon Bank sold $3.5 million worth of stock 2 weeks before the collapse.
Yeah. Ultimately, the hubris of the Fed thinking that they can manipulate the world and achieve outcomes that will please politicians is coming to an end. I remember that great line from Gladiator when the fighter says the time for honoring yourself is almost over. Hmm. That's kind of where we are, Russell Crowe.
What happens if a startup is supposed to pay 300 employees this Friday? The money's just not going to be there. They're not going to be able to.
No.
Make payroll.
Listen, FDIC is the most competent agency in Washington. When they say you'll have access to your money this morning, you will.
Yeah, that's what they said over the weekend. I've got a position in a private equity firm that was banking, a Silicon Valley bank, and they sent out a missive over the weekend saying the same thing. So hopefully that'll tamp down some of the hysteria, Bill Ackman.
The shorts helped this very much. The shorts were working on Silicon Valley Bank for months. Little whispers, oh, the bank's in trouble. And so the small treasurers, the little startups out in the valley said, whoops, I need to make payroll. I have to pull my money out of Silicon Valley Bank, and we're going to put it in Chase. Okay? That's why the bank failed. Now, with Signature, it's a little different. It's crypto.
Right.
And the same fears started with Silvergate. That bank goes down, and then everybody thinks, whoops, what's wrong with Signature? Well, there wasn't anything really wrong with Signature, but if the depositors leave, the bank fails. That's it. 10-to-1 leverage, guys. If the depositors leave, the bank collapses.
So you were just mentioning it now that they can't raise rates anymore.
No.
Right. So the implications of being really stuck now, the Fed, they're all the rhetoric about taming the inflation monster, and right. Now we're a bobber in the water.
No, I think it just shows that the illusion and the nonsense that really comprises most of the discussion about interest rates in the economy is false. And the fact is we have at least mid-single-digit inflations as a permanent fixture of the American economy. This is going to have big political implications down the road, as you both know. This is why the left has gotten traction in this country. It's because inflation is killing working people. Republicans need to figure this out. You know, they won't win elections until they figure this out.
Well, we need a crash course in the last 15 years of Fed policy, among other
right.
things, and federal government fiscal policy. But that's the sort of 2- and 3-step analysis. I think evades too many, unfortunately. But so. Where we're at, where we're going to be is, well, where we were for the 70s, which is a decade of malaise, stagflation.
No, we'll continue with inflation for a while. The Fed is not allowing deflation. Okay, they're not allowing in the 1990s kind of scenario yet, but it will be forced on them. That's the thing. They think they're in control, but they're not. You know, they've lost control of their balance sheet. They can't reduce it. It's going to stay just where it is. And I think that's the reality here, is the Fed has made inflation an institutional, permanent part of the American landscape. Even though they sit there and talk about fighting inflation, they can't. Because every time a crisis occurs, they write a check, as you were saying, Dan. And it just gets thrown on the pile.
And so what's happened in the last several days, that now, because, as you suggest, they were caught flat-footed, now they're going to be gun-shy, and so we're just going to be in stasis because they don't need any other high-profile banks to fail. They don't need this to be happening all over the country. And so we're just going to hold serve and hope for the best?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? That clip you played from Janet Yellen is striking. I love the Captain Kangaroo reference.
She was great as Captain Kangaroo. There's no question.
I've always thought she was related to, her the uncle in the Munsters. If you put the two pictures side by side, it's really quite
Grandpa,
striking.
You mean?
Grandpa.
Grandpa, yeah, sure. I could see that. She's a versatile actress. Anyway, but you were saying, why was what Captain Yellen said so striking to you?
Well, I don't think Janet Yellen has much credibility with the bond market. Putting her on television before they had a plan was a mistake. She should have canceled the appearance and let the regulators do their job, which is what they did. The press release they put out in the afternoon told you what you needed to know. Janet didn't contribute to the discussion at all. And I think, Biden is making a terrible mistake keeping her a treasure. He needs somebody with more financial experience and less economic credentials. And we have a lot of other people in the Biden administration who need to go, too, because, you know, the housing market, Ginnie Mae, is about to melt down. And we do not have the people at HUD to deal with it. So they'll figure this out eventually. But that's the way Washington is. As Churchill said, we always try everything possible until we are forced to make the right choice, right? And that's kind of where we are now.
And so, but the good news is that we'll soon have happy days again, because no more interest rate hikes, and the government is going to backstop things like bank runs, and so we can return to some facsimile of the halcyon days of quantitative easing, and we'll see the Dow and the Nasdaq run up.
No, because here's the thing. If we even leave rates where they are today, Dan, it's still going to hurt a lot. It's going to push us into recession. They may not be able to raise Fed funds to 6. I think it'll be closer to 5. But the point is, it'll still hurt, and you'll still have a lot of pain in the banking industry. Half of their capital is impaired at current interest rates. So unless they push rates down to 3 points, you don't get rid of the mark-to-market losses on the books of banks. That's the trade-off. Your banks are zombies. Half of their assets can't be sold because of the interest rates, and they can't lend. So you may get your stagflation, actually, if they keep rates at current levels.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm anticipating.
President Biden's going to address the country later on this morning.
That should be illuminating.
He should have Janet with him.
Yeah.
They could wear Captain Kangaroo suits.
Right, they could do a little putting on the rich routine from Young Frankenstein.
For because of bad tweets.
This is quite a little sticky wicket we're in, huh, Chris?
Yes. It's what happens in a democracy after a long period of prosperity. You have the incompetents and the careerists in all of the wrong places, and then something happens. You know, there's no Carter Glass or Harry Stiegel roaming around Washington today. We had giants in Washington 100 years ago who actually understood money. These people have no money. They're all looking for money. So as a result, they sound good, but they really don't know what they're doing.
Christopher Whalen, investment banker, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, author of Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, and editor of The Institutional Risk Analyst. Chris, thanks as always for your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've got banks failing. We've got debt accumulating. We've got tax increases proposed. But what White House spokesman KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat, wants you to focus on
is what?
Is the sisterhood of the traveling pantsuit. Take a listen.
Introduction and have joined us in the briefing room before. And so I'm going to keep it short, but a couple of things I do want to say at the top about the two of them. Chair Ross has led the Council of Advisor for 2 years as of Sunday. This is her third tour of duty at the White House, and she previously served as dean of the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. She is also the first black woman to be CEA chair. Director Young has similarly led the Office of Management and Budget for almost 2 years. She previously served as the clerk and staff director for the House Appropriations Committee and knows the Hill and appropriations as well as anyone, maybe better than most. Shalanda is the first black woman to be OMB director. You may be sensing a theme here. Stick with me for a second. But I do want to take a moment to note the historic nature of the moment that you see in front of you right now. All three of us are historic first in our roles. The first black woman to serve as CEA chair, OMB director, White House press secretary. The first black women right in front of you for all of those three important, important key roles in the administration. Now, that did not happen by accident. It is thanks to this president, President Biden's leadership and commitment to building an administration full of the best and the brightest. And I am so proud to be standing with two of the best and the brightest in this administration.
That was my favorite Oscar speech last night. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Best and the brightest.
Yeah. Uh-huh. She forgot to mention she was a lesbian.
She did. She focused on race and gender there, which is, of course, important. That's the most important thing when you want to talk about, you know, economics. The race and gender of the people that are heading up the Office of Management and Budget or chairing the Council of Economic Advisors. That's what you mainly care about, right? The race and gender of those individuals.
Oh, of course. Yes. But it's National Women's Week or something, right?
Does it ever get enough? Does it ever get to the point where you're willing to say what you're thinking silently? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you think that's being nice? Letting Karine Jean-Pierre, who is
not getting any better at her job, by the way.
But right. By any sort of objective standard, is not in the conversation about the best and the brightest at anything, as far as I can tell, from her performance, you know, merit-based analysis. But does it ever, do you think it's being nice just to indulging this sort of self-congratulatory identitarian bilge? Because we do that all the time. And it's infected every institution in America. And silence. Silence. Why are we afraid? Why are you afraid to say, you know, just enough already? Yeah, I see. You're a black woman. Congratulations. I don't really care. Just do your job like I do my job, like everybody else does their job. Talk about the time for celebrating yourself will soon be at an end, since our friend Chris Whalen invoked Maximus and Commodus from Gladiator. That's all this is, this merit-free congratulating oneself.
Got a text message. I thought MLK said he looked forward to a world where we were judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skin.
That's not good enough.
I guess that's out the window, huh?
Yeah. So is that cliche.
Somebody
Address it straight away in common parlance without invoking, you know, sort of the go-to quote from Martin Luther King. It's just nonsense.
Well, it's getting old.
Is it? Isn't it? I think so. But I understand people are afraid. The question is why and what will it take to confront said fear? I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. This exchange, which is a much more illuminating and relevant exchange. I mean, that's a good example of what everyone is being subjected to. But here's a good example of somebody making it safe to say out loud what you believe, because silence in the face of ignorance is not being nice. That is not the definition of nice. congenial, being a good person. It's the opposite of that, actually, isn't it? The postmillennial writer Savannah Hernandez, she does some interviews, you know, man on the street stuff. Savannah Hernandez is a woman of color. And that's not how she identifies, but she identifies that way in this interview with some honky college student for the purpose of getting past the lies that we say out loud so that we can sound like a good person. So you can say to the mob, hey, hey, I'm on your side. You don't have to go after me. Listen to this interview from Savannah Hernandez.
I grew up as a white man, and you're the exact opposite, you know? And so it's like my experiences are going to be different from yours.
How come?
I think, you know, there is a thing of, like, white privilege.
What privileges do you have that I don't have?
Oh, see, that's a question I keep asking myself. Because, like, in this day and age, like, all the laws, I say all the laws, you know, it's hard to speak on something I'm not fully knowledgeable of. So, like, I'm sorry if I, like, make a mistake in saying this. But it's
Don't you think it's a problem in society when white people think that they have more privileges than brown or black people?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the agenda that's pushed off, because personally, it's like, not that I think I'm more privileged than anyone else, because I had to work to get where I was, and that's like...
So why do you have that mentality immediately where you, you know, kind of apologize to me, like, let's talk about privilege, let's talk about I'm a white man in America, so we could have grown up differently.
I got you.
Why is that your first initial reaction to me as a brown woman?
Wow, you're getting me good. See, these are the kind of conversations that I love having. And I think it comes from a place of, like, I wouldn't say caution, but, like, in this day and age, people are so quick to judge and react and cancel. And so I guess it's that like, caution to go into an interview like this. I'm like, I don't know where we're at. But now I know where we're at, and I can, like, go for real.
Oh, I can go for real now. I know you're not going to attack me for being commonsensical and standing up to any identitarian blather that you may spew. So now I can tell you honestly what I think. I mean, we've asked this question so many times over the years, but I mean, is that really how you want to live, like that kid? Is that how you want your son or daughter to grow up? Trepidation as he enters any conversation, particularly with a person of color?
Yeah, when he realized she wasn't woke, he was comfortable to stop with the virtue signaling.
Now we can have a conversation like two human beings.
I'm in a safe space. Okay.
You really want that to be how our society operates? We need to, you tell a lie, and then I indulge that lie until we both agree that we're lying, and now we can talk like human beings? Is that how you want your interactions to be? Frank, Arlington Heights.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. This is Russell Crowe, greatest actor of all time. I won Best Actor for Beautiful Mind in 2001, and also won it for Gladiator, of course, in 2000. It was my signature movie. And you just mentioned, one of your previous callers had mentioned me, you mentioned my character, Maximus. Great character in that movie. Real man. Real strong man. Went up against Commodus. Terrible emperor, great fighter. Of course, the great emperor he was serving was Marcus Aurelius. And I think the question we have to answer right now is, are we at the end of the Pax Americana like they were at the end of the Pax Romana at that time? It's a big question. Do you have any questions for me?
Your most recent movie, because Poker Face was awful, but sorry.
No, it was awful. Was very bad.
Unhinged. How about Unhinged? Did you channel the Russell Crowe that throws telephones out the windows of hotel rooms for that role?
Actually, yes. You know, sometimes personal experience in your life actually helps your acting. It does. But I can't always help what the screenplay is. I don't write the screenplays.
All right. I want to understand here the. Give me a Mel Gibson versus a Russell Crowe, since they're both Aussies. Can you do a Mel Gibson?
Frank?
Oh, did we lose Frank?
back, yeah.
Oh, so. Frank. Oh, yeah, Frank. Oh, Frank. All right, so Mel Gibson versus Russell Crowe.
Mel Gibson versus... I can't do Mel Gibson.
No, no. You can't. All right. I wanted to see if you could perform.
We can't perform for you on demand.
Well, I mean, I know, you know, he practices these, obviously, and I wanted to see, like, if he could, if there's the nuance in the Australian dialect that he could nail. That's all. You know.
I love Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, though. I'll tell you that. That was a great movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
And then Payback, too, was good.
And
but,
you're...
you guys have a good...
Yeah, your question as Russell Crowe, at the end of Pax Americana, that's a good one. It's an operative one.
No,
thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. Uh huh. Ryan, New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. The other thing that I think is important to mention here is this kid's insistence on using the word conversation, and oh, I'm so glad we're having this conversation. Thank you for engaging in this conversation. You also hear that from, like, every politician, including so many Republicans. Glenn Youngkin did an interview on the trans issue I saw last week, public
CNN
forum.
Town hall, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just on and on about thank you for engaging in this conversation. Can we just cut out all that crap in the middle and actually start talking about underlying premises, or are we going to still hover on the surface and thank each other for the courage to say something to their fellow man? I think it's ridiculous.
Totally agree. Thanks for the call, Ryan. You know what thank you for the conversation means?
What?
It means I'm uncomfortable with this conversation. That's what it means. I don't want to have this conversation.
Right.
You're making me uncomfortable. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to converse. And you can understand, but the other side, they will triple down on triple threats, on die, and boy, if there was ever a better rearranged acronym for me than that, I don't know what it was, because that's what it is. It's a cultural, societal killer, die, and it's a religion. I'd like to enter this as Exhibit A in the case that it is so. Oklahoma State Representative Regina Goodwin, testifying before a House committee on education-related matters in Oklahoma, the state Board of Education chairman. Listen to what she says about DIE and her response to any pushback against it, because, you know, Oklahoma is a conservative state, so there's pushback. She's in a distinct minority, and I'm not talking about because of race. I'm talking about her viewpoint on this. But do you think that inhibits her at all in Oklahoma?
That's very disturbing, to say the least, when we have, again, a state superintendent who does not want to have anything to do with diversity, equity, inclusion. DEI is in deity. Diversity, equity, inclusion is God.
Thank you for your debate.
DEI as in deity. Diversity, equity, inclusion is God. Any questions? So do you get a better sense of the urgency of the situation from comments like that from a state legislator helping you along? You seeing what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Tim in Woodstock.
Hi, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. You know, I had a laugh when I heard KGP say that this didn't happen by accident. I don't think anybody... is really under the illusion that it happened by accident. She was most certainly told by some white lefty behind the scenes to make sure that everybody knew that these boxes were being checked. And it's going to take black people themselves, like the lady we heard interviewing that young man, to say enough is enough. I'm not going to go out in front of the cameras and preach the God that sort of gospel that you want me to preach anymore. We're done with it. We're done with the condescending. That's what's going to end it.
Thanks, Tim. George in Naperville.
Dan, I could do Mel Gibson. What's up, sugar tits?
Okay. I hope that was dumped. I presume it was. Not that Mel Gibson. I knew something from Road Warrior. Something from
Braveheart, maybe?
Passion. Braveheart, yes. Not Mel Gibson in, at dinner.
One of those days.
Oh. All right, we need a cleansing breath after that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Which election is most important to you of the elections that occur on April 4th? Is it the Chicago mayor's race? Or is it your local municipal races, particularly school board?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
What do you think will have the most impact on your quality of life, particularly if you have kids still in school, K through 12, that is? Barrington District 220. A guy named Joe Lazar, who has an organization called Vision 2020, has been posting online about what's going on in Barrington 220. Good stuff. And here's some of the recent testimony at school board meetings from parents in Barrington 220. And interestingly, and on an encouraging note, a lot of parents showing up at these District 220 school board meetings to talk about the kind of content in the classroom and the library in 220. For example, here are some parents describing the porn that is available for grades 3 through 5 in Barrington, District 220.
Grades 3 through 5, all about romantic and sexual feelings and masturbation. How is it age appropriate to require 6 through 8 graders to define vagina, anal, and oral sex? No part of these standards are acceptable.
First of all, both of these books are openly anti-Christian. This book is gay goes as far as to say that David, from David and Goliath, was homosexual. There's a chapter called The Ins and Outs of Gay Sex, where the author talks about blowjobs, handjobs, detailed descriptions, even goes as far as to give instructions on how to clean out your rectum prior to having homosexual anal sex.
Gross.
That's not wholesome. That's not the half of it, though. Let's get to the glossary. We have a glory hole. You know what a glory hole is? How about rimming or scat? Apparently, scat, I learned this from this book. Scat is apparently eating poop. Scissor sisters? Are you all out of your minds with this?
Are they? Does any of that make you uncomfortable? I mean, if you're uncomfortable, you're surprised to hear it on our airwaves. Think how surprised you'd be if your kids were being instructed on it.
We're
in the primary
our
grades.
Kids' minds at such a young age. It's uncomfortable to hear as an adult. I cannot even imagine. Take yourselves back, people, to when you were in third and fifth grade. Are you kidding me? This is the devil.
Or when your kids were.
Yeah.
If they're not currently. Another mom.
You know what these books are about. You've seen them. They're way too graphic for kids. At a young age, you can ask any clinical psychologist. Kids aren't supposed to be seeing this. How many in this room could stand up right now and tell me you don't want your kids to see this in school?
And when she asked how many in this room would stand up and say you don't want this, everybody in the room stood up. I mean, except the school board members,
right,
of course. No, not them. Uh-huh. Now, to offer the other side, here's a culturally Marxist mom in Barrington defending the books and the lessons that you just heard other parents describing.
I'm advocating for the right for my children to have access to books they may eventually want to seek out. We should not be spending our time trying to censor, ban, or erase the experiences of an already vulnerable population.
really? So why not have like hardcore porn in the libraries and in the classrooms? Because, you know, kids may eventually seek this out. Why wait? Right, Mom? The board members there, because there's a school board election there, and there are three candidates that are challenging the incumbents. Board members that are pro-porn in Barrington 220. Meet Leah Collister-Lazari.
As a board member, it's not my job to screen books. There's many, many books in the library. We have qualified staff, qualified librarians.
Very reasonable.
Anybody else?
Yeah, it's experts. We have the experts. Who am I to substitute my judgment? Who are you, Mom and Dad, to substitute your judgment for the experts we have on staff?
And this is why Governor Pritzker wants to control who the librarians are and who the school board members are, putting $500,000 into it.
The board president, Barrington 220, mm-hmm. a woman named Sandra Ficky Bradford. What she hears when parents are testifying about what their kids have brought home, what she hears and sees is good reference material.
Barry, I kind of felt about this one, like you felt about the other one. I felt it was a good reference, and I thought it would serve more than just the LGBTQ community. It talks a lot about safe sex and what's appropriate and things like that. So I think there was a lot in that book, not just for the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, for everyone. Who wants to sexualize children in any which direction, in every direction. It's not just for the LGBTQ anymore. And she mentioned Barry because she's enlisting another Barrington 220 school board member, Dr. Barry Altshuler, who's a pediatrician, as I understand it. Well, Dr. Barry Altshuler and the rest of the board were treated to a parent who referenced the guidance by the American Academy of Pediatrics on the topic. And by the way, the American Academy of Pediatrics, we've discussed on this show previously, they're a ghastly woke organization when it comes to COVID, when it comes to all the identitarian business.
Yeah, they're pushing puberty blockers, which can harm children.
Right, but even a ghastly organization like the American Academy of Pediatrics that's been completely taken over by Marxists, even they won't go as far as the Barrington 220 school board will. What does that tell you? Take a listen. First to the parent, and then enter the good doctor, Barry Altshuler.
The American Association of Pediatrics strongly cautions against exposing children to pornographic content.
American Academy of Pediatrics. This is one of the country's leading authority on pediatric care. This is just one of many credible sources you might want to research on porn exposure versus kids' mental health. Quote, sexual predators have purposefully exposed young children to pornography for the purpose of grooming children for sexual exploitation. Pornography exposure at these young ages often results in anxiety for the child. Children also report feeling of disgust, shock, embarrassment, anger, fear, and sadness after viewing pornography. These children can suffer all of the symptoms of anxiety and depression. They may become obsessed with acting out adult sexual acts that they have seen, and this can be very disruptive and disturbing to the child's peers who witness or are victimized by this behavior. Children under 12 years old who have viewed pornography are statistically more likely to sexually assault their peers. In sum, children exposed to pornographic material are at risk for a broad range of maladaptive behavior and psychopathology.
So if your child, your teenager, has a good friend who's having some gender issues, and it doesn't have to be genderqueer. It could be somebody who is gay or a lesbian. A book like this would be very helpful for them so they can support their friends. And I think it's very important that we have these kinds of books available in our library. This is I guess I call it mature themes, but It's not too mature for our high school kids.
No, of course not.
Oh my God.
Of course not. There's no way, better way to support your friend than to be well versed in how to clean out your rectum before you have anal sex. That's how you support your friends. Right?
Who are these ghastly devils? I mean, they've got to be defeated on April 4th.
There's a book called Flamer that's featured in Barrington 220. Parents, you may want to pick it up. One dad spoke to the board about it. And then enter Dr. Altshuler again, the good doctor.
So first in Flamer, there is a part of this book where a bunch of boys masturbate into a bottle. And they say that whichever boy does not ejaculate has to drink the bottle. Now, can any of you look at this crowd and objectively say that that is not obscene?
I have to talk about Flamer just for a second, okay? I am not Filipino. I am not in the closet. I am not Christian. I was never in the Boy Scouts. And this book spoke to me.
The book Flamer spoke to Dr. Barry Altshuler, who's a pediatrician. Anybody up in Barrington taking their kids to Dr. Barry? What else is going on in the schools? Not just when, in terms of content, but in terms of what that one mom was speaking to about the impact on this sort of instruction with pornography on these young fertile minds. Apparently, it's Caligula. Gore Vidal would blanch at what's going on in Barrington 220, according to what some parents are reporting.
First of all, my middle school son has a kid that repeatedly masturbates in the classroom. My daughter, again a middle schooler, had two things happen to her. She was in the girls' bathroom stall going to the bathroom, and two stalls over, she heard noises. Sounded like boys, she said. So she finished up and started to head to the sink. When her friend walked in and went towards that stall, the door was now open. She saw two boys having oral sex in the stall.
Is that why you moved to Barrington?
This is Barrington.
Is that what you want your daughter to experience in the bathroom at school?
They should have called the cops.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Apparently, this is all in furtherance of providing the kids with good reference material, making sure kids are allies to their friends. That's what Leah Collister-Lazari and board president Sandra Ficky Bradford and the good doctor, pediatrician Barry Altshuler, seem to think. What do you think? I don't want to be a prude here. Maybe I've got it all wrong. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Sean and Darian, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so School District 86, Hinsdale. My kids go to Hinsdale South. Obviously, April 4th is the election, and I've been told by several people that Catton with the C-A-T-T-O-N, Greenspan, are the two for sure conservatives need to vote in. So, and then this Gallo is in the middle of the road. I guess there's three spots to fill. So 2, 3, and 4 should be the ones to vote for. 1 and 5 are lefties, big time. And as a matter of fact, the mayor of Darien is endorsing the older woman, candidate number one. And she is far left. I mean, so that tells you a little bit about what our local politics is.
Thanks for the call, Sean. Appreciate that info. D86 in Hinsdale, punch candidates listed 2, 3, and 4. According to Sean, we're trying to get to as many as we can. Barrington 220, there are three candidates that are running that, based on good information I have, should be the candidates who earn your votes. Okay. They're not on the Caligula program for the classrooms and bathrooms at Barrington 220. Leonard Munson, mm-hmm. Matt Sheriff, Katie Baldassano.
Munson, Sheriff, Baldassano. Remember those names.
Yeah.
And if you've never voted, your kids don't have to go to school in order for you to have a voice or have a vote. You can just live in Barrington and vote.
Are you surprised by this? Not just in Barrington. Are you surprised to hear what's happening in Barrington? Ad in Glen Ellen.
The League of Women Voters had a panel for the District 87 candidates in Glen Ellen Elementary and Middle School. And I think there were nine candidates. Out of all of them, they were asked, you know, what should the board's role be in curriculum and all that? And every one of them said, leave it up to the educators. We'll rely entirely on educators to decide curriculum, and we won't step on their toes. And I got to be honest, it was difficult for me to pick out anybody. Everybody is so afraid to answer the question the way it really needs to be answered. I mean, obviously you could pick out the extreme, the radicals and the way they spoke, but even I think there's some moderates on there, but it was really hard to figure out from that discussion who to vote for.
Well, that's a failure of those candidates then, Ed. Thanks for the call. I appreciate that. D87 in Glen Ellen. Here are the three candidates I understand that should be supported. But to Ed's point, these candidates aren't making it clear how they're separate and distinct from the perspective of the other candidates. If they're even bothering to participate in a Plague of Women Vipers forum, is there a worse organization than the League of Women Voters? I know there's a lot of competition, but they're right near the top. What a joke that organization is. You think that's a nonpartisan organization? Do you still believe that? Do people know anything about the League of Women Voters? That
they
is an organization that is entitled to zero legitimacy. That is a hard left, pro-Marxist organization run by offals. Angry white leftist women, females. Angry white leftist females, offals. District 87, three candidates I have here in my little cheat sheet.
Okay, what do you got?
For the two-year term, Gendris. For the four-year term, Wilharm and Kenwood.
Wilharm and Kenwood.
Okay. Yeah. If you want a little bit more math and reading and a little bit less anal sex, seems like those are the candidates that to be supported in District 87. I gave you the 220 candidates. It's up to you. I mean, go either way on it. I know it's a tough call. Lee and Hammond.
Hey, guys. You know, can somebody please explain to me why it is, in order to teach young pre-adolescent kids to be tolerant, it's necessary to teach them different kinds of sexual practices they probably in the normal world wouldn't be getting involved with for maybe another 10, 15 years? Why is it they have to take this and do this to young children?
That's a great question, Lee. Why is that? There must be some motivation. Gosh, I wonder what it is. Do you think it's just a philosophical difference in pedagogy, do you think? Is there something maybe a little bit more political and cultural about what these political activists masquerading as academics or educators are doing? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the House passed a resolution calling for the big guy, Mr. 10%, President Biden, to declassify declassified information as to the origins of the COVID virus, perhaps provide more detail to the report out of the Department of Energy on the information that led the Department of Energy to conclude that the virus originated in the Wuhan Virology Lab, a lab leak. KJP, one of the best and brightest, so she says about herself, the White House spokesman, was asked about this. Well, so what's POTUS going to do? Is it going to declassify? You're thinking about it.
Will the president sign the legislation that would declassify information about the origins of COVID?
So, look, I know that it was just passed, if I remember correctly, it was just passed out of the House today, right? So we're taking a look at the bill. We have continued to share information, as I've mentioned many times before, with members of Congress. And as you know, the first few months of the president's administration, he came into office. He directed the intelligence community to declassify information assessing COVID origins and to make that report public to the American people, because we know and he understands how important it is to get to the bottom of COVID origins. We will continue to use every tool to figure out what happened here. While also protecting classified information. Again, we're going to take a look at the bill. I just don't have anything to share on how we're going to move forward at this time.
Also passed it unanimously. So why would President Biden not something that we literally got no opposition in Congress?
I totally understand. It is the right of the President of the United States to look at the legislation that is going to be coming before him, and we'll have more to share.
I got an idea. Why don't we do it like the FDA is going to do it with the Pfizer vaccine trials and parcel out this classified information, declassify, you know, over the course of the next 60 or 70 years. Maybe we could do that, you know, just slow walk it a bit.
Right.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Dr. Marty Makary, Professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, Chief Medical Advisor to Sesame Care, and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Good to be with you guys.
Congratulations on your testimony before that House Select Committee on COVID. That was very powerful. You, along with Dr. Jay and Dr. Martin Kulldorff, was great stuff. And we have appreciated your expertise over these many years. We continue to appreciate that. So what about the release of the intelligence? I know you've called this a no-brainer that this was a lab leak, but any reason there would be any hesitancy in releasing and declassifying information that relates to the origination?
I don't understand why you would classify anything related to the Wuhan lab origin. What, are we trying to protect the lab or protect China? I mean, why would anything be confidential in a democracy like we have? So we need more transparency, not, you know, hiding behind the guise that we can't tell you this because it's classified. The reason this stuff has been deemed classified and not revealed is that it looks bad for Fauci. The only reason there's a debate about the Wuhan lab leak is that it's embarrassing that we were funding the lab.
We also heard from Dr. Robert Redfield, the former head of CDC, last week, and he sort of offered a revelation that creates more questions around Fauci and Francis Collins about how he was cut out of email exchanges between Collins and Fauci and top virologists as to origination. Why would you cut the head of CDC out of those conversations? Maybe because he had a different instinct on the topic than did Fauci?
Well, this is a well-known bureaucrat move in government, is if somebody disagrees with you, you cut them out of meetings, and then you create this little infrastructure of people gathering and you convene the people you want who agree. And then if somebody disagrees outside of that, you say, well, we already have this big structure in place and the experts have already met and they already decided. That's exactly what happened. The only problem for Fauci is that three of the top virologists in the U.S. at that early meeting that he convened told him it came from a lab. One of them said, I don't see any other plausible explanation. And two of those scientists changed their tune in 4 days, writing a puff piece for a medical journal. And so that is the weaponization of medical research itself. And I think that's what's going to look bad for Fauci at his hearing.
But then he denied it, too. He said, no, I didn't. I had no part of that. So that's part of the lie and the cover up, don't you think?
The cover-up is, you know, worse than the actual event where he convened the experts. If he would have said, look, we convened the experts, and they told me it was from a lab, and I just had a different view. Instead, he basically got two of them to write a puff piece, and then both of those received $9 million in NIH funding after the puff piece. So he's got a lot of explaining to do. And by the way, why not just come out and ban gain-of-function research or condemn it in all of perpetuity? We need a universal worldwide ban at this point. The fact that he's not asked for it or called for it says a lot. I mean, he's kind of digging into his position.
Well, wait a second. He just said recently that you don't like gain-of-function research, Dr. Makary? Well, the flu vaccine is the result of gain-of-function research, so there.
Yeah, the flu vaccine is entirely different. When you get the flu vaccine, you're getting a piece of the protein coat of a flu virus. You're trying to figure out the protein coat. So it's totally different. I think he's desperate right now. This looks really bad. Also, what I'm not sure is completely well-recognized among all of this sort of Fauci file stuff is that the night when he found out it came from the lab, he made an emergency call at 3 o'clock and wrote an email at 3 o'clock in the morning to the guy who oversees the gain-of-function committee. I mean, clearly he was panicking knowing that wrongdoing happened at the NIH.
I wonder what your reaction is to lockdown files across the pond in the UK that have former PM Boris Johnson and former health director there, Matt Hancock, into some hot water. You know, the sort of subject to a lot of hewing and crying right now about how they were looking at this through a political prism, thinking about what this could mean for their political careers, how they had to manage information flow to manage the British people, which doesn't sound dissimilar to what happened here, particularly when Fauci famously told the New York Times, you know, I parcel out information about things like herd immunity as I believe the public can handle the information. But, you know, I'm sort of two minds on it. One is political actors behaving politically. That's not a surprise, and attempting to scare the public for the aggrandizement of their power. But at the same time, there was wide swaths of the public, both in the UK and the US, that wanted to be scared.
Well, Matt Hancock, who is basically sort of a Fauci equivalent over there, he's not a physician, but he led the public health efforts. This guy has been littered in scandals. I mean, not only was he breaking the rules that he put forth on the people, but he had leaked evidently thousands of messages to the media, and he has been the one sort of found to be sort of like Governor Cuomo insisting that people go to nursing homes. He rejected the idea that you should test people before they go to nursing homes for COVID early on. So, you know, these guys are basically in a quagmire right now, political scandal.
You wrote this piece, the New York Post, that we talked about on the show the other week, that I have now since laminated and I hang it around my neck. It was the 10 top myths that have now been debunked about the COVID response and the basis of the response, the lockdown policies and mitigations and mandates and so forth. I wonder, as you look back on the last 3 years, was there anything that was important that the political power structure, the presidents and the public health people at the top, the Faucis and the Birxes, was there anything they got right?
Well, out of about 30 major public policies, maybe they got one or two of them right. And I would say at the beginning, you know, I supported the lockdowns early on because it was scary in New York. We didn't know what we were dealing with. But then it was very clear that young, healthy people had a 10,000-fold difference in risk. Matter of fact, we don't know if any healthy child in the U.S. has ever died of COVID. The CDC won't tell us. It may have been one or five or zero. We don't know. So we imposed tremendous restrictions on 50 million children. You know, the hottest thing right now in medicine, in academic medicine and in public policy and medicine, I would say are three topics: climate change in medicine, equity, and fighting misinformation. If you apply for grants, that's what the grants are looking for right now among our ivory tower elite in medicine. And I'm concerned about misinformation, too, but the biggest propagator of misinformation has been the United States federal government. I mean, telling people they had nothing to worry about regarding COVID for months before it hit, telling people to wash their hands like crazy to stop the spread, telling people vaccinated immunity was better than natural immunity. I mean, telling people the lab leak was a conspiracy, masking toddlers, closing schools, bypassing the FDA customary advisory committee vote before approving boosters in young people, which should have never been approved. I mean, the government has spread a tremendous amount of misinformation, and it's not early on when they didn't know what was happening. It's digging in for years after the evidence has been apparent.
Yeah. So, do you think we'll ever get an apology?
I don't think so. I just don't think politicians are wired that way.
Yeah. So the top three priorities in medical care and public health, did I miss it? Did you say quality and cost of care? Were those in the top three?
No. Ironically, they are not right now priorities in terms of what getting the funding and what hospital payments are based on from Health and Human Services.
So, I mean, beyond, I know you've made this point, as have others, you know, one of the byproducts of the government being the largest purveyor of misinformation and using fear-mongering is that you have a lot of people that were not anti-vax, that you sort of turned into anti-vax because they don't trust the government, they don't trust the big pharma companies. What are the other negative consequences in terms of our overall healthcare in America from the way that COVID was handled?
Well, people aren't coming into the hospital anymore. We're telling them to do things. We're asking them to take medications. They're seeing advertisements for medications. They are now anti-pharma. They're anti-government. They see the long arm of the government in promoting the misinformation that vaccine mandates were going to increase vaccination rates. They did not. George Mason University study found they didn't. What it did is it hardened people and it created never vaxxers. I personally can tell you, I knew some high-risk people where I was trying to convince them to get vaccinated early on. Mm-hmm. And when the mandates came out, they dug in hard. I might have been able to convince them. They were probably on the fence. But when they saw a broken promise from Biden, who they didn't like for whatever reason, and say, we're not going to have vaccine mandates, and then flip on that, saying, you're going to lose your job, and you already have circulating antibodies? Too bad. They're the kind that we don't like. Fauci doesn't approve of them. Those are from natural infection. That hardened people because it was academically and intellectually dishonest to tell people, you have antibodies, but they're not the kind that we're going to recognize. They have to be antibodies produced by Pfizer or Moderna's product into your body. And that's where they just said, okay, we're done with this. We don't trust you guys at all.
Well, was anybody getting kickbacks from Pfizer or Moderna?
It's amazing. You know, Fauci has done, 5,000 interviews in the media during the whole pandemic, and no one's ever asked him that question. Have you been paid by Pfizer or have you been paid by Moderna? Not a single journalist has ever asked him that question. Isn't that amazing? Well, now, Rand Paul asked him, and he basically, you know, wiggled around the question.
Well, the problem is the journalists, quote unquote, on all those shows, their shows are underwritten by Pfizer. So they don't want to upset their sponsor, as we saw. I wonder, too, this is sort of a stop, look, and listen question that we've asked before. But, you know, at this point now, within professional circles, and we asked Martin Kulldorff this last week, too, do you see any contrition? I mean, and I don't mean formally, I apologize and all that. I just mean anybody walking it back and say, boy, you know what? We got a lot wrong. I got a lot wrong. And we need to learn the lessons of this. We need to not go down some of the roads we went down again. We need to think about how we repair our legitimacy in the eyes of a large number of Americans, our patients. Are those conversations happening within your professional circles?
No, it's quite honestly, Dan, the opposite, where people are saying, oh, I wasn't for closing schools. I was actually against them. Or I wasn't for masking toddlers. I actually thought that was excessive. When they were totally pushing to arrest surfers in California and close parks in Michigan, I mean, the medical establishment knows nothing about business, poverty, education, and yet they shut it all down for 2.5 years in some places. And when you look in the final analysis of a country that was open, free and clear, with some basic precautions for older people and high-risk people, Sweden. And you compare that to Michigan, which had the has the exact same population and the same number of older people. Michigan had double the deaths with some of the most restrictive policies in the country. And so there's this denial right now and this almost sort of revisionist history that everyone's coming out. Because, you know, when Jay and Martin and I were talking about this stuff 2 years ago, it was a lonely place. Yeah. You know, we were getting canceled, and now it's a bandwagon. Everyone's coming out and saying, oh, I wasn't for the lockdowns. I supported schools being open. Not true.
They're still going through the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, perhaps. They're just at the denial phase, so maybe there's hope. Dr. Marty Makary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to SesameCare, and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Makary, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I have a question about the Chicago mayor's race, but before we get to that, since we were talking a little bit at the beginning of the show about March Madness, I did, and also that includes the IHSA state title games over the weekend.
Yeah, where, sorry your guys lost.
Yeah, Bennett lost to Moline. They got two kids going to Iowa that were tough, apparently. And Simeon lost to Metamora, too. That was a bit of a surprise, but speaking of IHSA and March Madness, connecting the two, that's what I do, connect dots. Caden Pierce was part of that Glenbard West team that won the state title last year, one of the best teams in the history of high school basketball in Illinois.
Yep.
And he is, I didn't realize this, but I was watching the Ivy League championship game, conference championship game, to see who would get the Ivy League berth. And Princeton beat Yale. I knew he went to Princeton. I didn't know Caden Pierce was Rookie of the Year in the Ivy League, and he had 12 points and 10 boards. It's pretty good. I think he's only 6'5", in that game where Princeton beat Yale. So congratulations to Glenbard West, Caden Pierce, who makes his first tournament appearance after being Rookie of the Year in the Ivy League.
Good.
That's
for
good.
Him.
Yeah, positive. All right, so here's my question about the mayor's race.
Yes.
So in March of 2021, Governor Spaulding, he's from Illinois. He's governor of Illinois. He said, quote, I'm genuinely considered to be the most progressive governor in the Midwest, if not the country right now. He said that just 2 years ago.
Yeah, I remember him saying that.
So why isn't this leading light of the left backing BLM Brandon? CTU's on board. SEIU's on board. The Massachusetts squaw, Lizzie Warren, she's on board. I saw over the weekend Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who is one of the out and proud socialists on the city council, noted that he's endorsed BLM Brandon along with 12 Dem state legislators who are also proud socialists, like Will Gazzardi and Mary Flowers and Teresa Ma.
Andreas Vasquez, the alderman for the 50th Ward. Yeah, he's all over.
The list goes on and on. All the socialists, all those progressives, you say progressive, I say socialist because I'm accurate, are on board. And where is the leading light of the left in the nation, according to him, Governor Pritzker? Why so quiet? He's endorsed city council candidates. Why wouldn't he endorse Brandon Johnson along with his socialist allies? I'm perplexed. Help me. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And they said they're not going to endorse anybody. They, meaning him, Juliana Stratton, they're just going to, and both of our senators, Duckworth and Durbin, said they're
Why?
Not going to endorse anybody.
They're all
anybody.
Proud leftists.
There's got to be
Brandon
something
Johnson
in it for them.
Is a proud leftist. Paul Vallis is a closet Republican, according to proud leftist BLM Brandon. So what is the confusion? What is the choice? I mean, you've got a BLM supporter. Mm-hmm. You've got an out and proud Marxist in Brandon, and that's who you say you are. He's black. Paul Vallis is a honky. We play identitarian politics in Illinois. What is the choice? What's the confusion?
I don't know. I it's very peculiar to me that they're sitting this one out. And also, too, I mean, Governor Pritzker lives in Chicago. So he is a resident. He has a vote. So even if you didn't ask him as governor, I wanted to follow up. Well, as a citizen, who do you like? But nobody asked that.
Well, he's in Chicago, and he's not in Wellington or north of the Cheddar Curtain or in the Caymans visiting his money. That he's in Illinois, right? I don't understand, because I know from the left that Jelly Belly Spalding is the real deal. He's authentic. Right. He's honest and honorable. So why wouldn't you ally with your allies? I don't get it. What possibly could it be?
Well, I found out that Mayor Lightfoot gave her opposition research to Brandon Johnson on Paul Vallis.
Well, that makes sense, because Triple Threat is an identitarian Marxist. She is folding in with her fellow travelers. Why won't JB?
What I think why she's supporting Brandon Johnson secretly by giving him this, she wants maximum destruction. Because with Paul Vallis, things are going to get better, but with Brandon Johnson, it's going to get worse, and that's going to make her look better.
Oh,
that
was my thinking. She's going to make a comeback in 27, is she?
You never know.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know. This is about JB.
Right.
Because I want to hear from the JB voters. Because these are, honorable people who supported an honorable leftist. This is what they believe. This is their standard bearer in Illinois. In the nation, perhaps, according to him. Gosh, it's just a riddle. It's a conundrum.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, Brandon is being honest about who he is for the most part. And I appreciate that from BLM Brandon. I just would expect the same authenticity from someone who is so forthright, who has been such an inspirational leader, who's done such great things for Illinois by hewing to the leftist line. And yet he's nowhere to be found. How can a national leader like J.B. Pritzker be AWOL? Huh. I'm starting to lose faith in J.B. Pritzker as a honest to good
progressive
new Marxist card carrying new Marxist. And if we can't count on J.B. Pritzker to advance the flag with the hammer and sickle, then who can we count on? Aren't you concerned about JB? I am. Tony, Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan. I guess people can talk about the mayor race all they want, but at the end of the day, the black voters are going to vote for Brandon Johnson. And I'm sorry to say that, but it's just a fact. He's also going to lose by at least 3 or 4 points.
No, the latest poll has him. I mean, Brandon Johnson, the latest poll, he's creeping in on Paul Vallis. Only 6 points separate them. Mm. Was before it was 12. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like there's a shift in the air. There's a shift for Brandon Johnson.
Even more reason for J.B. Pritzker. I just want to understand the J.B. Pritzker phenomenon.
I can't explain it. There's got to be, there's something
what
there.
Possibly
what
possibly could
there?
It be?
What Gosh. Could it be? Dan, help me out.
Again, you have to start from the premise, the things that we all know are true. Yeah. He's authentic. Okay. He's honest. Oh, yeah. He's courageous.
Oh, very courageous.
He is committed to the agenda of the new Marxists that have wrestled control of all of our cultural institutions and, in Illinois, all institutions, period. So, you know, I'm just so disappointed. Aren't you? Aren't your friends on the left disappointed in JB? Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Dan, I just want to say I'm just amazed how you can be so articulate with your tongue firmly implanted into your cheek as you say these things. We all know that Pritzker's just a political opportunist.
What?
I mean, he does have his ideology, but this doesn't play out to his presidential aspirations. He can't be seen as somebody who's seeing a socialist, seen as supporting a socialist.
Wait a second.
No, but he is a socialist.
I think that's what it might be. I mean, I may be wrong.
Wait, Kevin, you're telling me that the guy who said all I ever wanted to be was governor or a member of Congress or the attorney general or the treasurer or the secretary of state, whatever. You're telling me that guy is some sort of political opportunist? What?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, a Chicago politician
heavens.
Is a political opportunist. I mean, I know it's a stretch and it's never happened before. But I think it might be the case.
I mean, thanks for the call. Well, if you can't believe in the ideological altruism of a J.B. Pritzker, then there's no Santa Claus. Is that what you're going to tell me next?
Maybe he's staying out of it because Paul Vallis quoted him and praised him for his view on Ron DeSantis, mm-hmm. that he's a right-wing extremist. Remember in that press release?
Exactly.
Stand with Governor Pritzker. So now maybe Pritzker doesn't feel like he should support Brandon Johnson because of that nice comment that Vallis
right, made. Right. He got buttered up by Paul Vallis, and that's what the basis on which J.B. Pritzker makes his decisions. I mean, I agree that he makes his decisions based on butter, but I don't know that he's listening very closely to Paul Vallis's rhetoric as Paul Vallis tries to credentialize himself by flying in formation with the men and women of the left of always here. I don't know about that. Mark Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I hate to echo the sentiments Kevin and Austin, but not only do I think he's going to run for president and someone who plans to vote for Trump a third time in 2024, there's a realistic possibility that Pritzker will be the president.
Thanks for the call, Mark. He said, I am the leading... perhaps the leading voice of progressivism in the country right now. That's the market position he wants to occupy. He needs to be that guy, particularly when you get to states with a heavy black population that dominate the Democrat primary, like South Carolina. What's he doing? I'm so, so confused. Someone who wants to remain anonymous. Well, go ahead. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, hi. You're on, Anonymous.
Yeah. Sorry.
Right.
So I actually was at the Illinois Education Association Representative Assembly last week on Thursday and Friday, and J.B. Pritzker actually spoke for about 10 minutes on Friday. I thought it was interesting that there was actually no press there, because normally when the governor comes and speaks at that event, there is some press coverage associated with it, and when he was giving in his remarks, he actually did say something about Brandon Johnson and supporting Brandon Johnson. So while he may not be saying things publicly to the particular audience that would support, has, you know, come out and supported him anyway, he has shown support for him.
Well, imagine that among all those teachers union folks that he would say that
exactly.
endorsed Brandon Johnson. Imagine that he would do that. But thanks for the call. I appreciate that that inside info. And, of course, the press doesn't need to cover the IEA meeting, because the IEA will just tell them what to print that came out of that meeting. They don't have to do any legwork there. They're the comm shop of organizations like the IEA and the CTU. But, I mean, so you're saying that J.B. Pritzker is some sort of typical fork-tongued politician who will tell the teachers' unions what they want to hear and then go behind closed doors with leftist Democrats in C-suites and law firm boardrooms and tell them what they want to hear to try to have it both ways? What? That would suggest that J.B. Pritzker is not a man of high character. We can't be talking about the same J.B. Pritzker. Right? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So as panic was spreading after Silicon Valley Bank collapsed at the end of last week, there was the typical misreporting by a D.C. press corps that is financially illiterate and disinterested in fact-checking. And so they got something wrong that I posted about over the weekend. The quote-unquote contagion was allegedly spreading, and the reporting was on Signature Bank in New York. As we talked about with Chris Whalen early in the program, Signature Bank in New York had a unique issue, just like Silicon Valley Bank had a unique issue. They were different unique issues. The Signature Bank in New York unique issue was their position in crypto. But Signature Bank of New York is not Signature Bank of Chicago. They're completely different banks. And ABC News used the logo from Signature Bank of Chicago in reporting about Signature Bank of New York, which, of course, created all kinds of consternation among Signature Bank of Chicago clients because they saw the logo on Clinton Foundation Donor Zero's Sunday program in the reporting. Completely different, both in terms of the actual institutions as well as how they operate. And Signature Bank of Chicago has none of the problems that these other banks have had over the last several days. So we wanted to get our friend Kevin Bestuga, who's the co-founder of Signature Bank of Chicago, on to talk more about this and set the record straight. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy. Good to talk to you guys.
I thought what you and your co-founders, Mick and Brian, did over the weekend was really smart, too. This may be only something I assume only Signature Bank clients saw, but you sent out an email detailing this and also providing your personal phone numbers in case any banking clients had any questions so you could stop some of any panic that was afoot before it started.
Right. You know, after the, the misreporting yesterday morning, that kind of set some things in motion, and we felt like we needed to get out ahead of any story that was going to happen with Signature Bank New York. Obviously, none of us thought that the FDIC was going to shut down, over $100 billion bank at 5:30 on a Sunday night. It was fairly surprising, but we've been trying to message to our clients and just people in the Chicago market in general that we're a separate and distinct institution. We're chartered in the state of Illinois. Signature Bank New York was obviously chartered in New York, but we want to assure people that our capital ratio, our liquidity ratio, our balance sheet is extremely strong. And I think, in times like these, communication is key. So appreciate you guys allowing me to come on.
Yeah, well, what happened with Signature Bank New York?
You know, Amy, that kind of remains to be seen. I talked to Dan yesterday, and I think the Wall Street Journal did a really good job in their Saturday front page article on Silicon Valley, sort of detailing what happened there and the dominoes that fell. As far as Signature Bank New York goes, I think what the regulators saw was probably people taking big short sell positions or attempting to over the weekend and assumed that it was going to be a bloodbath this morning as far as their stock price, which, like with Silicon Valley Bank, in turn caused depositors to panic and essentially run on the bank. So I think they were anticipating that. It remains to be seen whether there were a ton of inherent credit issues with the bank, meaning bad loans, but I think the postmortem on that is going to come out rather quickly.
Well, that's another important distinction. Signature Bank Chicago, your bank, privately held, locally run.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And this this weekend did nothing but reaffirm the fact that the three of us want nothing to do with being publicly traded, especially with the the speed at which information travels with the 24-hour news cycle, it's, as we saw yesterday morning with the misreporting on ABC News, we had to get out in front of this before it took on a life of its own.
Yeah, and that, and this, you're talking about speed of information, and that was really key. I mean, arguably, Silicon Valley Bank wasn't, it didn't necessarily have to go the way that it went, but when there was a call to shore up $1.8 billion in losses that Silicon Valley Bank experienced by having to sell bonds before their maturity, that created panic, and then that panic spread to the Twitter, which spread to all, you know, the VC community, which caused this run on bank, the run, which caused the run on that bank.
Yeah, and I think, you know, their deposit base is pretty unique, right? There's a lot of obviously VC firms that were banking with Silicon Valley Bank because they've been in that tech market for a long time, and they were really kind of first ones on the frontier of that business. So they had a lot of depositors that were extremely substantial in terms of the amount that they had deposited. And naturally, people that are in the VC business choose to take risk with their investments, and they're very risky. So they certainly don't want to take risk with their deposits.
Yeah, and again, Silicon Valley Bank, just to distinguish it, not all banks are created equally, operate the same, have the same customer base, and this is important to understand. Silicon Valley Bank, by its very nature, as you were describing, they had a lot of their deposits were from IPOs and SPAC deals. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported Silicon Valley Bank banked almost half of all IPO proceeds in the last 2 years. And so that's just a very different client base and dynamic than, say, Signature Bank of Chicago has.
Correct. Very different. You know, they had a massive influx of cash in the last 18 months via those IPO deposits, which in turn caused them to invest in the bond market like most banks do. We certainly do as well. And with a rising interest rate environment, bonds that were purchased in 2020, 2021, 2022 have an inherent unrealized loss. And they were forced to sell those bonds to generate liquidity to fund the deposit outflows. And it just created, a death spiral, if you will. So
is that something management should have seen? I mean, obviously, they understand that bond prices and interest rates have an inverse relationship. And so should they have been caught in that predicament? Or was this sort of was it moral hazard created by, you know, government policy over the last several years? Was it mismanagement? Was it a combination of the two?
I think it's some combination of the two, Dan. It's tough to say, without really getting into the organization and talking to people about how it was managed.
Yeah.
Certainly, there's been a lot of press over the weekend about the rate at which the Fed raised interest rates, which caused this unrealized loss on a lot of banks' balance sheets. What I don't think anybody could have predicted was the speed of the outflow of cash. I mean, I've seen a couple different numbers, but Thursday at Silicon Valley Bank could not have been a fun day. And with the level of automation that customers have and access to their funds, the money was flowing out by wires that people were generating on their mobile apps. So really, when you talk about the speed at which this happened, it's incredible.
But you know what's incredible, too? According to NBC News, they said that the bosses gave themselves a bonus check on Wednesday. Everybody got a bonus check.
I did see that, and
yeah.
I didn't see the article. I did hear that, don't quote me on this. I don't know for sure, but supposedly the CEO of the bank had been unloading shares over the last couple of weeks. So
yeah, $3.5 million worth.
A pretty big indication of moral hazard. But there's gonna be some questions that need to be answered there.
Yeah, the shares used to be $600, and now they're nothing.
So what's your handle on the banking sector right now in Chicago, which obviously you know intimately and to the extent you have comment generally nationally?
Yeah, I think, what the regulators are trying to do and what they tried to do in closing Signature Bank last night with such speed is to just stabilize the perception of the strength of the system, right? So the Federal Reserve announced a program yesterday where every bank can now pledge investment securities at the Fed to gain access to liquidity if needed. That's certainly a welcome measure. So that's basically giving banks the ability to pledge those securities that are underwater to create liquidity to fund customers' deposit outflows. We received communication from the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago this morning that they are ready and able to help in terms of supplying liquidity to its member banks, of which we are one. So they're doing a lot to stabilize the system and just prevent panic. People are certainly concerned if they have balances over $250,000, which are uninsured. I would not be surprised if the FDIC did what they did back in the Great Recession, in that saying basically all deposits are formally insured. I'm not sure if they're ready to take that step yet. I think it'll depend on what happens this week with deposit outflows.
Chris Whalen is an investment banker from New York. We talked to earlier in the program, basically said, look, this is going to be a mess that the banking sector has to clean up and will pay for in terms of loss of shareholder value, as in the case of, for example, Silicon Valley Bank. And depending on exactly what the Fed does, perhaps with respect to some uninsured deposits as well. Is that your handle? Is this a blip, or is this something that is going to have to be addressed as things develop in the coming weeks, where we're not going to exactly know the full extent of this for a while?
I think it's the latter, Dan. I think it's this is going to take a while to develop. I think if there's a bright side to this, it will force bank customers to really get to know their bank and get to know how strong it is, or what its weaknesses are, what are its lending practices, what are the sectors that they lend to that could have some exposure. And I do think it's going to take a while to leak out and rectify. I think the biggest risk right now is just depositor perception that, I can only keep $250,000 at each bank because that's what's insured. I think the FDIC is going to get out in front of that this week, but it will take time to, restore that confidence back in the system.
At Signature Bank of Chicago, your bank, what were like some of the recurring questions that you got from clients and your response to address some of these concerns you're describing generally?
Most of it was just confusion with Signature Bank New York. It started last week with CNBC, and a bunch of outlets put out an article about what was happening with Silicon Valley Bank, and all those articles were mentioning Signature Bank as having cryptocurrency exposure. They were sort of pioneers in that market. And so just the natural confusion with the two banks having similar names, really started all the conversations and concern from customers. But I think what sets us apart is, first of all, we're not a $100 billion bank. So we're small enough and we're community focused enough that our depositors know who we are. And we have those personal relationships with the decision makers at the companies that we bank. So the three of us certainly took a lot of calls over the weekend. We're going to be making a lot of calls today. We put out, some clarifying emails, as you referred to. Anyone who has any questions about the bank, we put out a statement on signaturebank.bank that gives access to the three of us. Our cell phones are posted, and I encourage anyone that has any questions or any concerns to contact us, and we'll address them.
All right.
Oh, does ABC owe you an apology for using the wrong logo?
Have they reached out to you?
Or
yeah.
Did they recant?
Our PR firm did reach out to ABC, talked to someone at the news desk yesterday. They were, I guess, somewhat noncommittal about whether they were going to print any retraction. So remains to be seen, but certainly that's not what I wanted to see on a Sunday morning.
Right. Maybe instead of your PR firm, you should have a corp counsel issue a demand letter over to ABC to suggest that it's important that they correct the record. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Those discussions will happen this week for sure.
There you go. All right. Signaturebank.bank at Signature Bank of Chicago. He's Kevin Bestuga, one of the co-founders. My business bank. Glad to know it's fine. That's good. It's always encouraging to know in the wake of all this and confusion. So we're happy to set the record straight, even if ABC won't. Kevin Bestuga, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you both. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.